We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
So hi, everybody. Welcome to our online event titled Web Accessibility 101, Tips and Proactive Planning. Our guest speakers today are John Folio, Accessibility Strategist at DeCue Systems, and Stephanie Kushnier, Business Development and Account Executive, also at DeCue Systems. I'm Hope Warner, K-12 Product Marketing Manager at Blackboard, and I'm going to be your moderator. All of us here at Blackboard are excited to be sponsoring today's event. We support K-12 communications with a community engagement solution that keeps your district connected to families and community members with websites, mobile apps, mass notifications, and social media management. We take web accessibility very seriously here, and we've worked really hard to make our website product meet accessibility standards, and we've created some free accessibility resources for all of you at your K-12 districts. Some of the resources we have available for free download are a proactive accessibility guide, guidelines for building a digital accessibility policy, and first steps for finding obvious accessibility problems. So I will put the link to download those resources into the chat. And let me find the right group to send this to here. The last time I sent it just to presenters. There we go. So let's dive into today's session. Website accessibility is all about giving everybody equal access to your online content, regardless of their physical or cognitive ability. In today's session, you'll learn the basics of accessibility, what rules and regulations apply to accessibility, and how to create digital accessible content. Speaking about all of these topics today are John Folio and Stephanie Kushnier. John is an internationally recognized web accessibility specialist and champion for the cause of web standards and universal accessibility. He has provided consultation services to government agencies, educational institutions, and private sector companies since 1998. John is currently at DeCue Systems, where he is a principal accessibility strategist, and he continues to remain very active in the W3C community groups, W3C working groups, and the W3C HTML5 Accessibility Task Force. That's quite a list there, John. And Stephanie has been doing business development in the accessibility software and consulting business since 2009. She is a certified professional in accessibility core competencies in the International Association of Accessibility Professionals and is dedicated to the ongoing mission of making online educational content accessible to all students, faculty, and families. Stephanie is currently the Director of Edu Business Development and Edu Account Management at DeCue Systems, Inc. So without further delay, the mic is all yours, John and Stephanie.
Thanks, Hope. Hi, everyone. Thank you for taking the time to join our webinar today. John and I are excited to share our presentation and, most importantly, answer any questions you might have. I'm going to quickly run through today's agenda before I turn it over to John. And he is the principal accessibility strategist here at DeCue, so he'll be guiding you through today's presentation. In today's presentation, we plan to cover a high-level overview of what is digital accessibility or web accessibility, guidelines and standards, as Hope mentioned, the impact on you, K-12 school districts, the proactive approach to web accessibility, and lastly, we will go over some of the steps to take if, in fact, you do receive a complaint. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, John, for the presentation.
Thanks, Stephanie. So I thought I'd start off this afternoon or this morning. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everybody. I thought I'd start off by very quickly talking about the different types of disabilities that we look at and we address when we're talking about digital accessibility. Now, these are broad sort of categories, but It's important to have a clear understanding of what it is we're talking about. So in the elevator speech, whenever I'm explaining to people what it is that I do, explaining about people with visual impairments is always the easiest thing, right? It's a very simple thing to sort of explain and communicate. I start off by saying that people who are blind can use the internet as well. And I tell them about the different types of assistive technology, whether it's a screen reader or a screen magnifier, or sometimes in the case of someone who's deafblind, they're using a braille output device. What's really important to understand, and what's important for us to understand as practitioners, is that when we talk about visual impairment, however, it covers a wide range of disabilities, from complete and total blindness to people that have low vision. And interestingly enough, the numbers kind of suggest to us that only about 1 in 5 people that actually claim to have a visual impairment or who are legally recognized as having a visual impairment are in fact completely blind, that the low vision community is significantly larger than that of the totally blind community. But we also talk about, people that are affected by color blindness. So we know that roughly 1 in 10 males in North America suffers from some kind of color blindness, traditionally red, green, but there are other types as well. And so when we talk about visual impairments, it's a scale. It's not a binary, you're blind or you can see, but it's somewhere on the spectrum of you have, 20/20 vision or 20/30 vision, right down to you are totally blind, and somewhere in the spectrum. When I do these types of seminars, when I do them in person, I'll often look around the room and ask how many people are in the room actually have glasses or contact lenses. And interestingly enough, the numbers are almost always consistent. It's roughly 1 in 3, roughly 30% of the room indicates that they're wearing glasses or contacts or something like that, which is a type of visual disability. So it really sort of brings it home that it's not just for blind people. Another type of disability that we're aware of that has some impact on the web. It's not as significant as the impacts that are that people that are visually impaired experience, but as auditory impairments. And again, when we talk about auditory impairments, it's on the scale from profoundly deaf to people that are hard of hearing and they have to use things like hearing aids and whatnot. In terms of assistive technology, hearing aids are the most obvious choice. There's also cochlear implants and some of those kind of more intrusive types of solutions. But in terms of accommodating people with visual or with auditory impairments, because the web tends to be a visual medium, really the only time auditory impairments shows up is when we're using multimedia. And so captions, transcripts are critical for people that have those types of auditory disabilities. We often will see as well sign language, although sign language tends to be reserved for really mission critical things. So we'll see governments and those types of organizations using sign language. But in terms of being prevalent on a lot of websites, it's still very, very rare. A different type of disability, a third type of disability, is one that we refer to as mobility impairments. And again, when we talk about people with mobility impairments, it ranges on a scale from profoundly or significantly disabled paralysis, whether it's a quadriplegic or those types of issues, amputees. You may have gross or fine seizure disorders or other forms of fine motor control, tremors, Lou Gehrig's disease, those kinds of things. And for people that in that sort of category of impairments, the types of assistive technologies that they use often will revolve around things like alternative switches or perhaps something like eye tracking or a head mouse. Oftentimes, some of the solutions will be pretty basic and simple, like the photo that you see in the slide here, where this gentleman's actually using a mouse stick. That's what it's called, and that's how you buy it. And by using that stick, he's able to tap on the keyboard. And while that may seem very kind of crude, for this particular user, it allows him to actually interact with his computer. So we have to sort of consider all types of input methods when we're talking about people with mobility impairments. One of the things that people with mobility impairments are starting to rely on increasingly is speech input. And we're seeing this more and more now. It's been around for a long time, but with the advent of mobile devices, with Apple Siri, with Google, with Amazon's Alexa, we're starting to see more and more speech input. And I think that as things continue to progress and advance, speech input increasingly is going to be something which we need to be aware of, which takes me to yet another different type of disability, and that is speech impairments. So again, as I said, today, speech as a disability and its impact on people using the web is relatively minimal at this point in time. People with speech impairments, you know, again, it ranges on a scale from completely nonverbal to having muscular cognitive issues that may impede their speech. And so, you know, while the impact is minimal today, it's something that we're certainly watching. I'm certainly watching very closely, again, because we're seeing changes in technology start to happen as well. I apologize for the dogs in the background. A fifth type of disability, or another type of disability, probably the hardest one for us to really sort of wrap our arms around, is that in the realm of cognitive impairments. Excuse me. Like all the other disabilities that we sort of looked at, cognitive impairments range from very severe, so something like Down syndrome or whatnot, to conditions such as autism, ADHD, dyslexia, and whatnot. In fact, this is probably also the largest group of disabilities that we see out there. And that's in part because some of the cognitive disabilities like autism or dyslexia, sometimes referred to as hidden disabilities, we still run into situations where people that have those types of impairments may not even have been accurately diagnosed. They may not be aware that they have autism or ADHD or something like that. The other problem is that a lot of these issues tend to be very unique or special. When we talk about people who are vision impaired or who are blind, blindness is a activity that we can sort of quantify and qualify. Whereas when it comes to cognitive impairments, each individual's needs are going to be a little bit more specialized, a little bit more unique, a little bit more personal. In terms of the types of technologies that people with those types of disabilities have, they use screen reading software, similar to people that are visually impaired. That's very useful for people that have dyslexia, for example. We've also seen tools like text highlighting and text prediction software that not only does it read the text on screen, but software will actually highlight the word as it's being read and written, spoken aloud, so that you have both a visual and an auditory reinforcement, which as educators, I'm sure you understand, is a very powerful thing. We're also starting to see a class of tools that provide image filtering and text simplification. A lot of these today are plugins that you can get into the browsers. But I think we're going to start to see more of that kind of activity and more of those kinds of software tools emerge in the marketplace soon. When it comes to the guidelines and standards, and when we talk about accessibility regulations, it can be a little bit complicated and a little bit complex. In part of the problem we have is that from a legal perspective, and I want to qualify that I'm not a lawyer here, and so I've been doing this for about 17 years, so I've got a lot of experience in the field. I've been watching what's been happening in the legal landscape, and so I have an informed opinion, but as always, we recommend that you talk to your general counsel. But when it comes to sort of legal requirements, part of the problem we're dealing with is we don't have a lot of regulations that have actually been taken all the way. We don't have a lot of legal precedent. Oftentimes, a legal challenge will start and it's settled out of court, or other kinds of accommodations or arrangements are made. And so we don't get a lot of sort of completed cases. But what we do know here in the United States is that there are a number of different laws that impact accessibility, as well as laws in other territories like Canada, Europe, and other regions. I don't want to spend a lot of time, as we noted, there are people here from around the globe. And so I don't want to focus too heavily on U.S. regulations, although I think the majority of us here are interested in that. So probably the most important digital accessibility law that we should be aware of is something called Section 508, which I'm sure a lot of you have already dealt with. Section 508 recently underwent a refreshment. The original Section 508 was released back in 1999, and 16, 17, 18 years later, it was getting a little long in the tooth. There was also a huge desire to harmonize the Section 508 requirements with the more global W3C requirements known as the Web Content Accessibility Guideline. And that has happened. It happened just recently in January of this year. Other regulations specific to educational institutions, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act also has a number of requirements in terms of accommodating students with different types of disabilities. The thing about Section 508 and that particular law is that right now that law primarily or mostly only is related to organizations or entities that, broadly speaking, are funded from the public purse. So in other words, public schools, public universities, state institutions and whatnot. It's further complicated in that Section 508 is a federal law. And yet education, for the most part, and laws around education and accessibility tend to be at the state level. However, most states in the United States have, in fact, pointed to Section 508 and said, yeah, that's the law you have to use. And so for most of those of you that are based in the United States, I'm sure you've been dealing with Section 508 for almost two decades now. The other law, the one that probably has an impact to private institutions, is the ADA, and specifically Title II and Title III. The ADA is an interesting example because when the ADA was written 25, 26 years ago, we really didn't have an internet, and so there's nothing specific or explicit in the ADA that talks about web accessibility. However, here in the United States, the Justice Department has signaled and communicated that as far as the ADA is concerned and the spirit of the ADA, that the spirit of the ADA did in fact include the web. That was, you know, by through the spirit of the law and the ability or the need to ensure inclusion, that the ADA should be applied to the internet. And they too have been using the W3C WCAG standard, which we'll take a look at in 30 seconds. So in terms of US requirements now, what we've seen is that both Section 508 as well as the Justice Department's sort of reference to the WCAG standard, that or the law on the land in the United States as of 2017 is we should be compliant to the W3C standard. That's important as well because, as I mentioned, there are laws in Canada, throughout most of the European Union, and other regions and territories. I know Australia, for example, has a lot of strong legislation in this area. And in all of these instances, these territories are also pointing to the W3C WCAG standard. So we have a situation where eventually, finally, we now sort of have harmonization in that globally, we can say that the WCAG standard is the one ring to rule them all, if I can steal that expression. And so the W3C standard, WCAG 2.0, the URL is here on the slide. It's https://tr/WCAG20. The WCAG standard was published in 2008, the December of 2008. It's currently being reviewed right now. It's probably going to be updated in the next 18 months or so. But what's important for you to understand today about WCAG is that it's based on four basic principles. Those principles are that the content, your web content, must be perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. And so, as I mentioned, in January of this year, the U.S. Access Board finally updated the requirements for Section 508, as well as Section 255 of the Communication Act, that basically said that going forward, WCAG 2.0 would be the new Section 508 standard. The major changes that were made to Section 508 to get it better aligned with WCAG was that instead of looking at it through the lens of product type, which was the original intent of Section 508, which was that they were looking at it from using the purchasing power of the U.S. federal government to enact changes. And so essentially the law was written to encourage or motivate software and hardware vendors to ensure support for people with disabilities by saying that the U.S. federal government wouldn't buy anything that didn't have that kind of support. I think the software and hardware vendors heard that message loud and clear. They did react in a positive way. And so I think now the Access Board has recognized that a shift towards functionality is actually more critical. As I said, they shifted to the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which I don't want to spend a lot of time on that today, but the WCAG guidelines have multiple levels of conformance or success criteria that are at different levels. Level A being requirements that are absolutely critical. Failing to meet a level A requirement would basically create a brick wall for people with disabilities and would ultimately ensure that at least some people would not be able to access the content. Most of the level A requirements are also the type of requirement that there's no easy workaround that can be applied. So it really is a brick wall. Level AA are also important, also have a fairly high barrier for people. If you fail to meet them, you're introducing significant barriers. However, a lot of the AAs, there are workarounds that can be done. And so that's just one of the distinctions. In terms of what you need to be compliant to, however, both the level A and level AA requirements are basically treated as equal. So you need to be compliant to all of them. It's not a mix and match buffet here. Section 508 also shifted towards specifying non-public facing electronic content as well. So originally Section 508 was just looking at public facing content. Now 508 also addresses things like internal intranets and those types of non-public content. And it really does require operating systems or ensures that operating systems meet their obligations as well. I think the really big thing to recognize is the harmonization, which for organizations like Blackboard, for example, who have a worldwide audience, worldwide clients, it was really hard to be creating software that met two separate standards where the two standards weren't in sync. So the harmonization with WCAG was probably one of the most important things that happened. One of the big things for you to understand is that the transition to the WCAG standard is going to be somewhat phased. And so the way that the transition or the way the upgrade was written, any content that's currently posted on the web today that meets 508 requirements does not need to be modified to meet the new requirements unless you have made changes to the content. So if you have a legacy web page and that's what it is, and it's, you know, the president's speech from, you know, 2003, and it's posted as a web page and that's the way it's going to be and you're never going to change it again, you do not have to go back and make any additional changes. However, if that web page is included in a content management system where you have overhauled the content management system, you've got new navigation structure, for example, or you've done a visual refresh in terms of design standard, then at that point, because that content is being brought into a new publishing platform, the new publishing platform will need to meet the new requirements as well. There are 16 new requirements that have surfaced that you need to be addressing moving forward that were not currently in the Section 508 requirement. And so any of that legacy content that's being moved into, as I said, a new content management system or something would also have to meet those new success criteria. A couple of examples of some of those new success criteria. The language here has been taken for the most part directly from WCAG. So for example, there's a requirement for meaningful sequence. What that means is that for people that have mobility impairments that perhaps cannot use a mouse, we'll go back to the gentleman with the mouse stick, they'll be tabbing on the tab key or the arrow keys on their keyboard to navigate through the page. And so as he's tabbing on his tab key, going from link to link to link, the order with which those links are being presented should be in a meaningful and sort of reasonable sequence. The last thing we want is a link in the top left-hand corner, followed by a link in the right corner, and then, you know, and jumping all over the page. We don't see that often, but sometimes using some of the layout techniques that we have available to us, we can see accidents or issues arrive like that. There's also now a requirement for color contrast that specifies a minimum color contrast between the foreground text and the background color. So for example, dark blue on black would not meet the requirement. Black on white would meet the requirement. There's also a requirement that the any text that is a hyperlink on the page, that the color contrast between that link and non-linked text also has a minimum contrast requirement. So that's new for people that have only been adhering to Section 508 for the past couple of years. I can tell you it's not that hard to achieve, but it is a new requirement. Link purpose, essentially what they're trying to avoid here is links that when taken out of context don't make any sense. For non-sighted users, one of the techniques that they'll use to quickly navigate through a web page is to pull up a list of all the links on the page. And I'm sure all of us have been to news type websites where you'll see the headline, there'll be a little bit of a teaser, there's a photo, and then it says read more. And if you have five or six of those on a web page and the non-sighted user brings up a list of the links, they'll have five links to read more, read more, read more, read more, and read more, which when taken out of context are meaningless. So the requirement here is to ensure that all links make sense when taken out of context. There needs to be multiple ways to find content on the site. So traditionally that suggests that you should have a site search and probably also have a site map, but there are other ways to address that. But there needs to be two ways to find all content on the site. And then in terms of error submission and form submission, that anytime an error is provided, that you do so automatically and provide error suggestions whenever possible. There are exceptions to all these rules, and there are times when you may not be able to provide automatic suggestions for corrections. But even then, when you submit a form that has some errors, there is a requirement that the error messaging that is returned is very explicit and very clear, so that the end user understands what needs to happen. So those are just a couple examples of some of the new requirements. Unlike the original 508 standards, the update 508 also applies to everything. So it not only does it include your websites, but it includes documents and things like blog posts, as well as your activity on social media, which is relatively new. And it's one of the areas that I've been watching very closely as well. Part of the problem we have with social media is that we don't have any control over the platform. And so that puts you as a content creator in a bit of a difficult bind, because you might be creating content that meets accessibility requirements, right? You're going to make a Facebook posting and you're going to make sure that the image does have good alternative text. But yet if there's some mechanical issues with the way Facebook is being interpreted or being received by somebody using assistive technology, so that they cannot interact with your content, who owns the responsibility for that? Is it your fault or is it Facebook's fault? And we don't have easy answers for that right now. The one thing that I recommend people today is that they should have a policy in place that clearly demarks where their responsibility starts and ends, so that if ever you have a challenge, you can say, these are the things that we can affect change on, so we're covered by policy and process there. These things are problems that are inherent to the platform that are beyond our control. I'm not saying it's a perfect solution, but anticipating any kind of challenge and being prepared for that is a strong recommendation. So some of the things that the final rule also specifically calls out as non-public facing content, so things like emergency notifications, final decisions, or those kinds of sort of important messages to the parents and whatnot, policy or program announcements. Some of these things tend to be kind of government centric. The way they read them, they sound government centric, but they are applicable to anybody that does need to be 508 compliant. So formal acknowledgement of receipts, for example, or questionnaires and surveys also need to be fully accessible. Some of these things were not specifically addressed in the previous section 508. So there you go. Again, one of the things that's really important is as we transition away from 508 or rather towards the revised section 508, remember that the existing content has been grandfathered in. There is a safe harbor clause in section 508 that says that anything that originally met section 508 in 2002, 2003 and is going to be legacy content does not need to be altered. The one thing that you do need to ensure is that you actually have proof of compliance. So if you've got some of that legacy content and the plan is to not make any changes to it, to sort of avail yourself of the grandfather clause, at a minimum, you do need to have proof that actually proves that you were compliant to the original section 508. And the other thing is that you basically have a year, not quite a year now, we've got another 9 months or so, but that any component or portion of your existing online presence that has to be compliant must be compliant by January 18th of 2018. So we have until essentially the Christmas break of this year to get our ducks in a row. And I know a lot of organizations are embarking upon that now. So there you go. There's the big date, January the 18th. And so prior to January 18th of 2018, the old sort of Section 508 standard remains in effect. In terms of that, we don't have a gap. There is coverage going forward. And so you've got essentially a year to get your non-procured ICT. So anything that you have created internally, as opposed to software, hardware tools that you may have purchased, but anything that you've created internally must be updated by January 18th. Another date that's more important, however, is roughly July, middle of July, end of July, early July, in that you have 6 months to get your acquisition regulations and procurement policies in place. And so we know, I'm sure you know, that part of the challenge we have is not only are there sort of technical challenges that need to be overcome, not only are there sort of legacy issues and the volume issue that we're dealing with, but that we need to have strong policies and processes in place to ensure that not only do we have a solid foundation to address sort of legacy content and where we are today, but that going forward, we have policies and processes in place that ensures that as we continue to add new content to the web, that it also meets accessibility requirements. And so from the perspective of the Access Board, I think that they're kind of telegraphing here that having this in place is probably the more important activity, because without these policies and processes, other things are just going to sort of be flopping around here without a strong guidance or strong vision. And so one of the things that you really should be focused on is getting your policies and process in place. You're all here from K-12, or at least that was my understanding. And so the question is, well, what's the impact on K-12? Whenever DQ is working with an organization that's in the EDU vertical, our approach basically is the same. And so I started to think about in terms of, well, what does this mean for elementary schools and middle schools and high schools, that K-12. And so really we classify, or I sort of classify, the content into one of four sort of content buckets. The one of the major delineators that I use is this idea or this notion of public or non-authenticated content versus authenticated or non-public content. So by authenticated, what I mean is that before you can have access to this material, you need to log in with a username and password. And because of that fact, because we need to hand out username and passwords to people so that they can become authenticated, by that very fact, the number of people that are going to be seeing our authenticated content is going to be smaller than the general public. The general public is virtually anybody. It could be me, it could be my parents up in Canada, it could be anybody could hit your site and you know, they are going to be seeing content that you have posted publicly. And so you have a requirement to ensure that, that material is accessible as well. The other sort of bright line that I use sort of to demark the content buckets is non-academic content versus academic content. And so by non-academic content, I'm thinking about things like district and school information, could be emergency communications, it could be information about sporting or community events, you know, whether it's a bake sale at a local school or one of the high schools is putting on a theatrical presentation, or the school band is doing a concert, those types of non-academic information and whatnot, lunch menus, e-newsletters, those kinds of things. And again, social media is in that category. On the other side, that academic content for non-authenticated would probably be access to library information or other online resources that you're providing in terms of e-learning, could be summer programs, anything that's open to the public. But has an academic flavor to it. And in thinking about sort of post-secondary or pre-post-secondary education, K-12, I was struggling to come up with other types of content here. I know in the university environment, for example, is library content. There's interlibrary sharing that happens. I'm not sure how relevant that is in your field. It may be in some large districts, whereas in smaller districts, maybe not. When it comes to non-authenticated, non-academic content, again, those two basic categories exist. There's the non-academic content, so that would be faculty and staff intranet, your HR, benefits, payroll, those kinds of things. There could be parent-teacher direct communications where, you know, the parents can be in communication with the elementary school teacher, what have you, email and telephone directories, that kind of content. Whereas academic content tends to be things like your learning management system, Blackboard or equivalent, your massive online activities, library collections I mentioned before, where, you know, it may be authenticated because it's shared content and whatnot. And so while all of this content does need to be, or you need to ensure that all this content meets accessibility requirements, in terms of sort of prioritizing or looking at the risk factors involved here, I would suggest to you that your public content, your non-authenticated content, probably has the highest risk simply because there's that many more eyeballs that have the opportunity to see that material. And oftentimes, a legal challenge or complaint is really initiated by one person. They will then partner with an advocacy group or whatnot, but most legal challenges are initiated by one person. And so the chances of a person seeing non-authenticated content is that much greater. And so there's that really is the metric for risk. I would say in the authenticated realm, a lot of these tools, and at this point we're getting into transactional kinds of web content, where, you know, for example, I mentioned the faculty and staff intranet, HR benefits and payroll, that's all transactional stuff. Oftentimes that's also sort of commercial off-the-shelf software that's being used. And so vendors of those types of systems, and I know Blackboard actually has been exemplars here, they understand the accessibility requirements. And so oftentimes these tools, these software packages that you're going to purchase from the vendors, they're specifically have been selling into the EDU vertical. They have a very clear understanding of what the accessibility requirements are, and they know they can't make a sale if their software doesn't meet the requirements. requirements as well. So in terms of, you know, if you're looking at a prioritization strategy, I would suggest that you look at your non-authenticated content first, because even though it's probably using a content management system as well, they're the category or the types of concerns that you're going to find are going to be editorial in nature as opposed to sort of mechanical in nature. That's a broad generalization, but generally speaking, that's usually what we see when we do assessments and what have you. And so again, right, I mean, when technical problems will be with the CMS or your template. So a couple of examples, right? Everything on the page needs to be operable through a keyboard. And so that is a feature or function of the software tool that's being purchased. And unless you've written your own software, which we hardly ever see that anymore, the tools that you are purchasing to use have requirements to meet accessibility requirements as well. And so consistent navigation, structure and relationships being programmatically determined, that's all in the code. And so you're going to be buying a software package with that code. There, your strongest sort of response is to have a really good policy in place, a third policy sort of purchasing policy, where as part of your terms of purchase with the vendor, that it's clearly called out the responsibility of the vendor to ensure that they are meeting accessibility requirements as well. So, you know, having that third party vendor policy in place is a strong defense for your organization, for your district. The other types of content errors that we see are editorial. So this is the content author thing. So for example, the web page, a vanilla web page in your content management system may be accessible, but then if you put a graphic in and you fail to provide appropriate alternative text for that graphic, you will be non-compliant. You will fail the compliance requirements, but it's not because of the software tool you're using, but it was an editorial concern that you failed to provide the alternative text. So in looking at the types of problems and addressing the types of issues that you may encounter, understanding where the problems can come from is a useful thing as well. Continuing forward, you know, some of the other technical issues that we'll see, the content's not accessible to the keyboard, visible tab focus is not there, video players or carousels or any kind of sort of movement on screen that doesn't provide the ability for the end user to pause or stop or hide that content. Though, you know, non-standard or invalid code is going to be a technical issue, whereas editorial issues, I mean, some of the biggest editorial issues that we see, especially in government and EDU, is the use of untagged PDFs. It's really simple to find something or to scan something and save it as a PDF. And PDF stands for Portable Document Format. It was originally envisioned as a electronic means of moving print media around. And so unless your PDFs have been tagged, where we go in and we actually add accessibility metadata and information to the PDF for assistive technology, that content's going to be inaccessible. That is a pure play editorial activity that needs to happen. That's that the software can help, but the editor, the content author, needs to take explicit and specific steps to ensure that the material is made accessible. Likewise, with multimedia content, you need to ensure that captions and described video and transcripts are also being provided. Ambiguous link text is another example where it's just the content author that goes in and says, read more, and puts that, makes that as a link. So these are the types of issues that specific will need to be addressed through education. The biggest problem we observe time and time again is content authors don't know what they don't know. And so that's probably going to be one of your larger challenges to overcome. So how to avoid a legal challenge, how to avoid an Office of Civil Rights complaint, OCR complaint. I would suggest that probably the biggest thing you need to do is you need to make a commitment. You need to recognize that accessibility applies not only to your students, right, but probably, especially in K-12, more often than not, the parents and employees, parents of the students and employees within the district. And I had to look to find a good picture, but I mean, here clearly we have two adults that are both visually impaired, and yet their child is not. And so, you know, as educators, this young boy will probably be in an elementary school. He seems to be elementary aged, and yet interacting with his parents, ensuring that his parents are kept up to speed, using electronic, whether it's e-newsletters or whether it's the district website or the school website, they need to be able to have access to that material as well. One of the things that and I hear concerns whenever we recommend this or wherever we suggest this. But one of the things that I like to tell people is own the fact that you probably have web content that is not accessible today. Admitting that you have a problem and owning up to that, it's a hard thing to do. And you know, when it comes to risk management and when it comes time to talking to your general counsel, they often get very uncomfortable about this. But admitting that you have a problem and turning people with disabilities into partners as opposed to adversaries, I think is an important step. And so, you know, being very candid and very upfront saying, you know, we've undertaken a review. We recognize there are some issues. Here's our plan. This is what we plan to do, which again, you know, policy and process is going to be important there. But having a working plan and asking people to partner with you. If you see a problem, let us know. And then having a policy in place that says anytime you get a complaint from a parent or a student or faculty member, these are the steps that we're going to follow to ensure that a complaint is addressed in a timely manner and the problem is resolved, that is going to stand you in much greater stead going forward than sort of pretending that we don't really have a problem, let's not talk about it, and let's just hope we don't have an OCR complaint. So again, I'm not a lawyer. It's a conversation you probably want to have with your general counsel, but it has been my experience that owning the problem and engaging with the community is a positive, proactive step, whereas trying to hide your problems and pretend that, you know, sweep it under the carpet is probably going to catch up to you in the long run. So what should you do? Well, take an honest look. Take a real serious look at where you stand in accessibility today. You know, this was not intended to be a pitch for DQ. We can certainly help you here. But my recommendation is bring in an expert auditor and do that deep dive accessibility audit. Take a look. What we do at DQ, we don't necessarily look at every single page. We'll usually start with a representative sampling, try and find web pages that are either examples of different templates in your content management system or different examples of the different types of content that you maybe are publishing on the web today. Oftentimes, especially with content management systems, when we find a mechanical problem, you fix that mechanical problem once and it'll cascade down throughout the entire website because it's in the code. Then you also need to, again, as I said, take a look at your editorial content. So, you know, you probably take multiple passes here in terms of looking at your assessment, but have that audit and then be prepared for what the audit's going to tell you. It's not going to be good news. You know, I mean, it's going to be some degree of this is where you are. You're not perfect, but here's how close you are. And don't be concerned. Don't be disappointed if you're not perfect there today. I'll tell you, I've yet to encounter a website that's perfect. And so what we're looking at here is a long tail solution. We want to get the problems addressed, but really, you know, you're not going to eat the elephant in one sitting. And so having a structured, proactive approach to remediation is also going to be important. So again, remember that while you have roughly a year to address your web content to be Section 508 compliant, the policy and procurement policy and process piece is due by July 1st of 2017. So I don't want to sort of sweep that under the carpet. It's an important date that I think you should all be very aware of. And so in terms of the types of policies or that you should have, again, we have three kind of recommendations that I would recommend. The most important is that you need to have an internal accessibility policy. That starts off by saying that, you know, recognizing that you need to be Section 508, or in the case of private institutions, that you want to be WCAG 2.0 compliant, and then set out policies and process there. Because in the EDU vertical in particular, but we see it elsewhere, but certainly here, we see a lot of third-party vendor districts purchasing software and hardware solutions. I would recommend that you have an accessibility policy for that process as well, that, you know, asks for and demands on voluntary product accessibility templates, VPATs, but also that it's clearly laid out in the terms of purchase and in your service level agreements and whatnot, who's responsible for accessibility. One of the things that you'll also probably want to contemplate, and this one's actually fairly large, is an exception procedure. You're going to run into content that you're going to be posting on the web that, for whatever reason, it could be a time issue, it could be a cost issue, there could be other issues, copyright issues, what have you, where you may not always be able to post content that meets the requirements for accessibility. You need a policy in-house. You need to know how to escalate something so that you can, in fact, get sign-off. We know that by posting this particular piece of content, we are going to be going out of compliance for XXX reason. However, because of YYY, we cannot do it at the same time. So, for example, it's a real-time video, and it's the, I don't know, the state championship of the high school football team or something like that. And that needs to be closed captioned as well, but it's being broadcast on community television and you can't get captioning happened right away, but there is an intent to also archive that final game and offer it up off the internet so that you can go back and you can see the game. And so in that case, your exception policy would say that, you know, because we can't get closed caption happen in real time, we're committed to having caption provided within 24 or 48 hours or something along those lines there. I'm not saying that's the best solution, but given that you may not have the capacity or the ability to provide real-time closed captions, you need to have an exception policy and procedure in place so that you can still do what you need to do and still ensure that going forward, you're not going to get tangled up in a legal web down the road. And then again, I mentioned previously, having a social media accessibility policy, I think is a really important step, simply because right now, social media, it's still a new and burgeoning environment, even though it's been with us for, you know, I think Twitter's closing in on close to 10 years now, 8 years, something like that. But it's still relatively new, and in terms of being used as a communication channel, that's still only been about 3 to 5 years. So it's a young industry, it's a young thing. But again, you know, platforms like Snapchat and Pinterest and Twitter and Facebook, they have their issues, and sometimes they're issues that are beyond your ability to address. Having a social media policy and accessibility policy within your district that recognizes that, but still puts the burden on content creators to do everything that they can. So even though the platform may not be 100% accessible, the content that you're producing to publish on that platform is meeting all the accessibility requirements of WCAG 2. Is a defensible position, right? Yeah, Your Honor, this is the things that we are doing, and these are things that we can't do because of the platform. And so there you go. Some practical next steps that you should be considering. I would say that, generally speaking, any organization, any institution, whether it's at the school level or whether it's at the sort of district level, I would recommend that you have a web accessibility coordinator. It doesn't necessarily need to be that term, but you should have a high-level designate who is responsible for monitoring reporting on web accessibility At whatever level is appropriate within your school environment. It could be at the school level. It could be at the district level. Again, there are so many variations of how that plays out that only you would best know the most effective place to have a web accessibility coordinator. But as high up the food chain as you can within the organizational structure of where you are would be what I recommend. Ideally, the web accessibility coordinator has access not only to the people that are producing content, to the IT department that may be hosting the purchase software products that you bought, but also can have relatively quick access to senior decision makers within the organization. The other thing that I would strongly recommend is start thinking about training right now. In the EDU environment, it is a highly decentralized publishing environment. Oftentimes by design, you have faculty members that are responsible for posting and producing content on the website that they are producing and whatnot. So most school districts don't have a large web team. Oftentimes it may be one or two people. It could be, you know, part of the larger IT department and whatnot. And so looking at training to the faculty and staff that are going to be producing content that's going to be published is probably an important next step. Training can be done. There are a number of different ways that training can be provided. It could be done, you know, over the shoulder, real time. It could be done instructor led. It can be done via webinars or online sort of self-serve, self-paced learning. And there are training packages out there that can be applied to meet any and all of those possible ways of providing training. And so the method by which you provide the training is perhaps secondary to the fact that you got to start providing training, the sooner the better. I would say that going forward, you need to ensure that all new content meets the accessibility requirements. That may be difficult based on the level of awareness. And so you may need to do some training before you can, in fact, ensure that all of your content is accessible. So again, you've been dealing with Section 5.8 for a long time. So a lot of your content producers should already have an awareness of some basic rudimentary things like providing alternative texts and whatnot. And so hopefully the training is really only a revisitation of what's required from WCAG, those 60 new requirements that we talked about. Your web accessibility coordinator should also be thinking about a corrective action plan. So again, we'll start from the assumption that there's going to be content today that doesn't meet your Section 508 or your ADA requirements today. So you'll need a plan, you need to identify the issues, and then you'll need a remediation plan going forward. And then finally, you should be thinking about a method of monitoring compliance going forward, right? We've recommended that you have some kind of professional audit. We've recommended that you provide some training so that going forward, your content will meet accessibility requirements. How can you then ensure that those activities are being successful? And the only way is to do a regular monitoring. Again, a lot of that can be mechanically done. And I don't want to turn this into a pitch, but it's one of the tools that we have is the ability to monitor your compliance going forward. So there are other tools in the marketplace. I encourage you to take a look, and I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, John. We have a lot of questions, so I kind of compiled them into a group. So the first one, we'd have a lot of people ask about video. So can you talk about some ways to make your videos compliant?
Sure. So the WCAG requirement actually mandates that videos must be captioned. They must have described video. And then there's a strong recommendation. It's actually a AAA recommendation for providing a transcript. So if the caption is for the deaf user, the described audio is for the blind user, and the transcript would be the screenplay, sort of the combination of the captions and the described video. Described video is very complicated to do, and so the way that WCAG has been written, there is a bit of a way out in that if you provide a robust transcript, that can serve as an alternative to the described audio. So at a minimum, the recommendation is you need to have two text files. One is the captions that is synced, that plays in sync with the video. And then you have a transcript, which, think of it as a screenplay, would be the closest sort of analogy that I would recommend.
Great,
in terms of how to do it, I would say most organizations today will probably look to outsource it. It can be done manually, but it is very time consuming.
Okay. How would you respond to folks who might be hesitant to post because of accessibility mandates?
How would I respond to them? You know, I'll never forget. I was at a conference a couple of years back. I was actually at EDUCAUSE in Philadelphia about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I found myself talking to the lead lawyer from the National Federation for the Blind. And it was right around the time when they had launched their challenge against Philadelphia State University. And he said to me, he says, you know, John, we're not here trying to sue for money. He says, what we really want to do is we want to get them to make the darn thing accessible. So my recommendation is, I mean, you want to make sure that you're not publishing new content that's egregiously inaccessible. But again, going forward, I think the most important thing you need to do is you need to recognize that you have a problem, and you need to be honest about that. And while you don't want to necessarily take out a full page ad, admitting that there are some issues and engaging the affected community and asking them to help you to be understanding and to be engaged in the process. If you find a problem, let us know. It's not going to get you out of hot water, but when you ask people to partner up with you because you want to make their experience better, generally speaking, their initial reaction is, oh, cool, I'm being listened to. My problem is being recognized as a problem. They're not just shutting me down. And so in terms of risk management, I would suggest that having them friendly is far better than having them angry. But again, I can appreciate that from a sort of risk management perspective. Lawyers, general counsel, those kinds of things, they may not always agree with that perspective. All I can say is that it's been my experience that when you are honest about it, that good things flow from it as opposed to bad things.
Thank you. Okay, Holly just put a question in the chat, and it summarizes a lot of the questions we got. What standards or requirements are necessary in order to deem an auditor as an expert?
That's a really good question, and it's probably there are a couple of ways I can answer it. Part of the problem is within the sort of web accessibility, digital accessibility industry, up until recently, we really didn't have any kind of way to certify or to assure that somebody who claims to be a web accessibility expert is in fact one. There's a gentleman up in Canada who's been doing this a long time, actually a former partner of mine, a guy by the name of Derek Featherstone, who joked once that the only thing it took to become a web accessibility expert was a trip to Kinko and a box of business cards. The reality is that our industry recognizes that problem. We now have something called the IAAP, the International Association of Accessibility Professionals, who are in the process of creating a standardized sort of process, a certification process, so that you will be able to know if somebody is certified or not, because it's being handled by this third party entity. Because the activity there is still new, the only other thing I would suggest is, you know, ask for provenance, ask for examples. If somebody is presenting themselves to you as a web accessibility expert, ask about previous work experience. Right now, our industry, we recognize the experts because they've been doing it a long time, because they have a body of work that they can point to. And that's hard if you've not been focused on this industry. But yeah, ask for referrals.
Hope, I did see quite a few questions about how we make things accessible. How do teachers learn about accessibility? What about teacher websites? And I just wanted to mention or have John address there's a lot of training out there and for raising awareness, for learning more, taking deeper dives into various things like PDF accessibility or content creation, you know, a variety of different kinds of training, curriculum online, as well as, you know, instructors or experts such as John giving training.
Great.
Yeah, only that they're increasingly we're starting to see more and more of that training material online. So I see that as a very positive step. And so whether it's the W3C or whether it's private entities that are providing online training, we're seeing more and more of it all the time. So in terms of how do we get the message out quickly and efficiently, that would certainly be one way of doing it. For those of you that know content management systems and whatnot, a lot of the training is also emerging now as SCORM compliant, which means it can be integrated into your learning management systems quite easily. So that's a huge benefit as well.
Wonderful. Thanks for bringing that one up, Stephanie. And I'm going to, I know we didn't get to all of your questions and I apologize for that. John and Stephanie's contact information is on the screen if you guys have any questions that you would want to reach out to them on. The last question I'm going to address myself just because we had some questions about Blackboard in general and our content management system. And what we're doing at Blackboard to ensure that our product is meeting accessibility requirements. So John talked about the two aspects of technical and editorial. So technical-wise, our Web Community Manager product went under an audit, and we have all of our templates are now ADA compliant, and we're actively making product updates this year. So all of our product updates will be done by the end of 2017 to meet all of the accessibility requirements. And then editorial-wise, like Stephanie was just talking about, there's a lot of online content for training and things, but we also have a lot of content on our community engagement resources page. And I'm going to put this in the chat for you guys. We have a lot of accessibility content on that in that link that talks about how to make your PDFs accessible and how to check for color contrast and all of those kind of things that you guys have been asking about. So hopefully that's helpful. So to wrap up here, again, we have additional resources on accessibility. The link is on the screen if you guys want to check that out. There's proactive accessibility guides, guidelines for building digital accessibility policy, and so on. So there's additional resources there. And then, of course, I want to thank our awesome speakers today, John and Stephanie. We couldn't have done this without you. And I know all of our attendees are going to go back to their districts with all this great information to share.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you would like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.